This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Yes, broadcasting at 99.5 on the FM dial and streaming live at WBAI.org. 9 p.m. Time now for Backstage Stories.
Now in my time of dying, I don't want nobody to mourn. All I want my friends to do, come and fold my dying arms, well, 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 so I can die easy, well, well, well. So I can die easy, well, well, well. So I can die easy, Jesus gonna make up my dying bed.
Good evening and welcome to Backstage Stories. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host. And we just heard In My Time of Dying, performed live for us by Ashley Noel Jones, who is part of the creative team and also a cast member of Mirrors. We will be speaking tonight about Mirrors' journey from stage to screen, with other members of the creative team, including Azure D. Osborne Lee, who is the playwright, and Paul A. Noticed II, who is the filmmaker. And I want to say welcome, Ashley, welcome, Azure, and welcome, Paul. I am so happy to see you. Paul, I don't know you, but welcome. I had the opportunity to work with Ashley and Azure when Mirrors was up and running on East 4th Street at New York Theater Workshop next door. And March 12th, 2020, everything shut down. Everything, the set, the costumes, everything had to be abandoned, and we all had to stay in our homes for what seemed like an eternity. But tonight, we are going to be talking about what has happened to Mirrors since the pandemic and in the pandemic pause, and how Parody Productions has made, will make Mirrors available to a much broader audience through your contributions. So once again, welcome. And Ashley and Azure, you can unmute.
Amazing.
And Paul, you can unmute. And I want to start off by asking a few questions of all of you, and you can decide, you can just jump right in and answer. Let's talk a little bit about your background, your journey as artist. How about we start with the one who gave us the world and the words of Mirrors, Azure D. Osborne Lee.
Hi.
Hey.
What's good?
Okay, so talk about your background, where you're from, how you got from point A, how you began your work as an artist, and tell us a little bit about where you are now.
Okay, so I'm from Tennessee and Texas. I spent about the first 14 years of my life living in East Tennessee, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is the Manhattan Project. And then just before high school started, my family moved to Houston, Texas. So you know, I went to high school in Houston and then moved to Austin for college and grad school. So we used to drive from Tennessee to see our family in Texas. So I really made a broad sweep across all those southern states many times in my youth.
How does that experience inform your work? That Tennessee to Texas, that southern thing?
You know, I think part of it is like diasporic feels, you know. So I grew up not close to my blood family because my parents moved us to Oak Ridge for economic opportunities in the 80s. I'm an 80s baby. And so I think for me, like feelings of separation from family and trying to like figure out who I am as a person, I got really good at building community wherever I was. And I guess I didn't realize how deep of an appreciation for the South I had until I moved up to New York and realized, you know, how rich the culture is in the South and how, I really feel like a product of the South.
When did you begin your relationship with words, with storytelling?
Ooh, my relationship with words began very early. I want to say probably about first grade, but in kindergarten, I did ask my teacher when was first grade because I was over kindergarten. and I remember feeling very frustrated that every day in first grade, I would, you know, I would go to school and there would be another coloring book picture on the desk for us to color. And I'm like, again? Aren't we going to do something, you know, hard hitting, do something with literature or something? So, I have notebooks from elementary school where I aspired to write and illustrate my own stories.
Was that action, was that behavior, was that creativity encouraged by your parents and by your teachers? Because I love it that you said, again, I have to do this again. And I would imagine some teachers would not appreciate that.
You know, I was not.
Because they were being lazy.
Yeah, I was not appreciated by all my teachers. And by third grade, they were like, please, let's get this child into gifted and talented. This child is over. I started, you know, I decided to organize my own beauty pageant for My Little Ponies when I was in elementary school during recess. So I made flyers and put them up. And I was, of course, the organizer and judge of the pageant. I think that in a lot of ways, I'm just really unstoppable. I have faced resistance, you know, from people. But I know my mom would be frustrated with me for gathering various things, you know, that she might have considered trash, but I considered art supplies. And finally, it was just, you know, put down some newspaper. Fine. Just put down some newspapers. So there's that. At 12, I decided to get my poetry published. Mm-hmm. So I became the published author at 12.
And who published you?
It was my poem Solitude was published by this anthology called Young Appalachian Poets. But also it was in the local newspaper. And I will say that our gifted and talented program was really robust in my town. It's government run. My ex-husband actually likes to to joke that I'm from Night Vale, you know? So it's like all these like weird kids being experimented on by the government. But they did teach us skills like bookmaking and how to do research presentations. We did stories with holes, also known as red herrings, a lot, you know, so that really encouraged my creativity and thinking, you know, a lot.
Okay. Ashley, where are you from?
Like Azure, I am a product of the South. So I am from Spartanburg, South Carolina. Grew up in Spartanburg, and came to New York for college, but I was definitely someone, I think, too, like Azure, sort of, I didn't have the same sort of appreciation, I guess, for the South as I do now once I moved to New York. Because, like, when I was a kid, I was, like, in kindergarten, and I knew, I was like, this is not the place for me. So I spent the next, all of my schooling plotting a plan to get out of Spartanburg, South Carolina, because I just knew that there was more outside of, you know, this weird sort of small town where I'm from. Actually, more South Carolina in the county of Spartanburg that's a little bit cooler now, I guess. So I grew up there, and as soon as I got into school here in New York City at NYU, and I was like, this is my ticket. I'm taking it. And I've only been back maybe a few times. I had to go back a little bit in between my freshman and sophomore years of college because I don't come from a whole lot of money, so I couldn't afford to stay at NYU. And I got a big scholarship right before my leave of absences that you can take ran out from Tisch. And I went back and completed my 3 years and, you know, all that good stuff. And it's just now that I've learned sort of like stuff that was already ingrained in me. Like when I got to school, it was a lot of like, get rid of your accent, change this about you, change that about you. And now I have such an appreciation for where I'm from and the culture that's there and the Black culture in the South of how rich and beautiful it is in a way that I couldn't appreciate before, that now I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy that I can trace my journey back there and know, like, you know, the roots of where I've come from. And, you know, on my mom's family, her family is all from the foothills of North Carolina. So it's a little bit of a different sort of culture there from opposed to like where my dad is from in Spartanburg, South Carolina. So yeah, I'm a Southern girl. Yeah. But now a New Yorker.
So you're an actor? A musician?
I'm an actor, a musician, an arts educator. So mm-hmm. I like Azure. I used to, my poor family, I spent all of my time driving them crazy where they'd be like, Ashley, please stop singing, because I would sing around the house all day, every day. I was obsessed with Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand, and I would make little programs. Fancy programs, put on like my mom's fancy dress and her heels, and invite my family to come to the Den and like come hang out for my show where I would sing the whole soundtrack of Beaches. So they were like, Lord, what is this child? But I fought that artistic urge for a long time. I planned on going to Wake Forest or, you know, like UNC to go do scientific research. I was really into genetics. I'm still into that part of science, and I went to science summer camp for several years, and that was my plan until I took an acting class in high school because my brother had taken it. And I got to be on the stage for the first real time, and I was like, oh, this is it. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And I went to my guidance counselor the next day and was like, I'm changing all of my plans. I'm applying to this school and this school and this school, and I'm going to be an actor. And she was like, you're crazy. I was like, I know, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I did. And my family, my mom, you know, I was raised mostly by my mom for most of my life as a single parent. And she was supportive. She was like, look, is it going to be hard? Yes. But if you love it and if you're going to do it, then I am here. And she has been my number one supporter as an actor, as a singer. And then my other found love, which is arts education. I oversee several after-school programs for a not-for-profit in Brooklyn and Queens. And it's the other great joy of my life. I had no clue that I would fall in love with three different parts of the arts and love them very much, almost the same, just in different ways. So it's been a cool journey to get to this multi-hyphenate place, which this didn't used to be a thing. If you were like, I do other things, people are like, oh, you got to focus on one. And now, thank goodness, people embrace it, where it's like, yes, be a multi-hyphenate.
Absolutely. How is it working with young people? Do you work with little people or do you have to work with teenagers?
I work mostly with elementary. So the programs I oversee are K through fifth grade. Mm-hmm. We have middle school programs with the organization that I work with, but mostly who I'm working with are little kids, and they are wonderful. I gotta say, they inspire me every day. I'm not in the classroom as much anymore because now I mostly do administrative work for the program, but the last couple of weeks I've been in the classroom a lot because I've done a lot of coverage at some of our sites. And man, they change the way you think about things. They inspire me. They make me a better artist. You know, my organization is really good that they've always known that art is my number one love and I have to do it to be good at having the job and doing the job that I do. But also I find that I'm a better actor by, you know, these kids' stories. And you know, the organization I work with is an organization of color. So like 99.9% of the kids in our program are kids of color. And I find that to be the most beautiful part, because it is giving back this arts to a lot of kids who just would have no outlet for the arts. A lot of kids who have other options in their neighborhoods where they are, that this is a positive influence on them, and letting them see something outside of the journey that might be their trajectory. Or, you know, as one teacher told me about one of my kids in the program, she's like, he's going to be a gang leader. And I was like, not on my watch, he ain't. So, you know, those are the kids that you invest all that time in, which that kid just had like an audition for a major like feature film the other day that I helped get, just because I was like, yeah, this kid is from Queens. He's amazing. He got too much energy. Let's put him on a screen. So, you know, gang leader kid is, you know, in my mind, going to be like some fancy actor in a few years. But yeah, they're wonderful. It's crazy. It's a lot, but they're wonderful.
We need educators like you to see past the label. Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous to label kids. It really is, because they grow up believing that they are not enough.
Exactly.
So thank you for the who you are and the work that you do with them. It is vitally important. And Paul A. Notice the second. How are you?
No, I'm doing great. I'm doing very nicely. Yeah. How are you?
I'm fine. Tell us about Paul. Other than being a Emmy award winning filmmaker and journalist.
Well, I got that right there in the background. I'm so proud of that damn thing. Every chance
Except
I get,
Paul, no one can see us. We're no one can just see voices. No one can see us.
No,
all the people.
It's there, y'all. The Emmy is real. I've seen it in person.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh Lord, but I guess the where I was thinking about that. I was like, where do I even start? I had a very wild type of trajectory. If I'm thinking about elementary school, I got into writing very early, and really gravitated towards journalism. Like, and I would do critic type stuff. So I would be a music critic or a theater critic. And actually later in life, that's what I did. In my early 20s, I wrote for Stage Buddy for like just a whole bunch of off-Broadway stuff. Like, that's what I did. Mm-hmm. But in the midst of that, I mean, speaking of multi-hyphenated, you know, my family household, everyone had multiple jobs. And so I kind of grew up with the understanding that I would have multiple hats. So I went from really being accepted to Georgetown for journalism and having a journalism like scholarship to switching, going to the School of Foreign Service. I was really into politics. I've always been in politics. In the middle of like my senior year, I think it was my first play that I wrote. It was my first play. It was not my first play, but it was the first play that I really in college that I wrote that took off, and I really liked how it felt. And I was like, I really like theater. I like just like Black theater. I learned a lot more than, you know, Tyler Perry. I learned about Susie Lloyd Parks and stuff, and you know what I mean, Adrian Kennedy. And I was like, oh my goodness, oh, you could be weird and Black and just do weird shit on stage, and that people are gonna get
cursing.
It.
No cursing.
Oh, I'm sorry. You can do weird stuff on stage.
You.
I'm so sorry. I apologize.
Okay.
But oh my goodness, you could do a whole bunch of weird stuff on stage. And just like, it wasn't what I categorized as weird was the things that I was oftentimes ostracized and marginalized in my youth for liking or wanting to talk about. So things like gender and sexuality, or things about the complexities of trying to, you know, I used to call it the diaspora within diaspora, being a Black kid in like the suburbs or going to a predominantly white school. There's a certain type of isolation and certain type of navigating that you have to do along racial lines, and people do it differently. Sometimes they go the Barack Obama route, which is trying to be the safe Negro route. And sometimes it's the right. Like, and other times it's the, who is this? Clarence Thomas route, right? Where it's like, you're just so afraid of what people hate about Blackness that you just hide yourself from it. Right. I mean, there's so many different ways to explore that. And I think that's what informed a lot of my writing early in life. And then once I got away, because I'm not gonna lie, I thought about leaving St. Louis. I grew up in St. Louis. It's a super racist town. and is very, I mean, there's just so much trauma that was associated. Seeing my dad get arrested, seeing just like so much normalized violence in neighborhoods and corporal punishment in schools, and just all this wild stuff that I didn't realize really shaped how it shaped how I saw the world in terms of learning compassion, empathy, because I had been treated so poorly that I had oftentimes wished that if people would understand what they're doing to certain people or certain marginalized people, that maybe they would change their behavior. And so a lot of my writing became that type of thing of let me share a light on this, you know, part of society that people are oftentimes demonizing or marginalizing. And, you know, of course, because it was St. Louis, it's oftentimes Black folks. Actually, it was always Black folks when I think about it. And from that, I found myself acting. And then because I was acting a lot in film, but I wasn't too successful, I kind of wanted to make some money and, you know, just wasn't paying as much as I wanted it to. So I just started making my own films and then I started getting hired for it. And I found that I actually really very much enjoyed creating the roles I wish I had when I was trying to act. You know, I can't tell you how many times it was Thug Number Five, or it was, you know what I mean? Like, and I'm not gonna lie, like it's sometimes disorienting to play someone who's so far from what you grew up with. Like, I grew up in what they would call a rough neighborhood, but I just wasn't rough. And, you know, to try to put on that persona, it just bothered me. And so a lot of times when I'm directing or when I'm trying to produce, even something as simple as a commercial, it's done in mind. It's done with the idea that there are certain stakes involved when I'm presenting these bodies on screen or on stage. And there has to be not necessarily a respectability politics, but a responsibility to tell a full truth and to not simply be lazy in your storytelling or to be lazy in your casting, to be like, well, I'm just going to go with this, as opposed to understanding like, wait a minute, let's have some inclusion. Let's actually make this a real life situation that people can gravitate to, as opposed to simply being an archetype or whatever. And I also run a nonprofit. That's like my day job is I run a nonprofit production company that works on literally developing things for marginalized narratives and marginalized communities. So most of my clients will be Black artists, nonprofits themselves, or a lot of these like arts or institutions where they're doing like art installations, and it'll be like, you know, a Black queer artist is like, yo, I want to do some wild dance stuff, but I want to like be able to put this into film. How do you do it? That'll be me. It's just been a long, long, wild little world. I love it. Yeah.
You talk about, you spoke about really and truly the importance of being a content creator, creating the work that you would like to see, creating the work that you would like to be in, creating the work that you would like to be part of, which talk about the importance of that. Anybody can answer that. Anybody.
Yeah, I can add one thing.
Okay, sure.
No, it relates a lot. I mean, it relates a lot to why I really was like just drawn to mirrors and really dedicated in a way where I honestly, you know, there's a certain type of heart you have for certain projects that hit you a certain way. And finding pieces like that, like this, where there's a complexity, where there's a story that is oftentimes not seen or highlighted, which, you know, I take a lot of that frustration of not seeing that work and I put it into the actual labor that's involved to make this thing, these types of projects, like a success. Do you know what I mean? Like the late hours when it's just like 40 hours in a row and I just got to get this thing done by deadline. Like what drives me is I'm like, yo, people need to see a story. I want my cousin to see the story. Like that's really what I think about, is like, not just like young kids at home, but people at home that I honestly, like, just like Ashley, like I barely go back home for a lot of very valid reasons. The last time I was home, I was pulled over by a cop, and that scared the crap out. It was just consistently a weird thing, but there are people back there who can't leave and they still need that. They still need these stories. They're not just spectacles. So, yeah. Okay. I think, yeah, I'm rambling a little bit.
Put a pin in that, because we're going to come back to that with mirrors. This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI. My name is Marcia Pendleton, and I am your host, and we are speaking with Azure and Ashley and Paul. Azure, please tell us about mirrors and how you became connected with Parody Productions. Who is the producer?
Yeah, so I initially wrote Mirrors in my first playwriting residency, which was with Freedom Train Productions, which no longer exists, but it was a company that served to highlight the lives of Black queer protagonists. It was started by Andre Lancaster, who passed away a couple of years ago. But, you know, when I first moved up to New York City, I had my first internship with them, and they offered me admission to their playwriting workshop. And so that's when I really started writing plays. And so the next year, I was a resident artist with them. I wrote Mirrors, and we had a reading, and a lot of time passed. I learned a lot about the industry. And then one day I applied for Parody Productions award there that they have. And so, yeah, I sent it in. I sent a couple of plays in because they like to get context for your work. So I sent two plays in. They really liked the play and said, you know, we would like to make you one of our 2018 artists. Mirrors had just had a workshop production with Downtown Urban Arts Festival, and it actually won the Best Play Award. And I was really eager to sort of get this show up and running. And so that is when, I teamed up with Parody Productions.
And I just want to share a little bit with the audience about Parody Productions. It promotes parody by empowering women, trans, and gender-expansive artists in theater. And they do this through commissioning and developing original plays, producing and promoting the work of playwrights, directors, and designers, and providing opportunities for underrepresented voices to work in theater. It is founded by and the person who is the executive and artistic director is Ludovica Villar-Hauser, who also served as director of Mirrors. And we want to thank her for the work that she does to amplify voices that are traditionally ignored, Azure, back to you to talk about what Mirrors is about. What's the story?
Yeah, absolutely. So Mirrors is set in a little town in Mississippi called Etheridge, Mississippi. And it's set in 1960. And essentially, it's the story of Alma Jean Pearson, who's a 17-year-old Black girl. She has just found her mother dead and has called the emergency number to have somebody come help her. And Bird Wilson is on the other end of the line. Now, Bird is used to be her mother's partner, but Alma Jean doesn't know anything about that. And so Bird comes and scoops Alma Jean up and takes her to Etheridge, and the two have to live together and get to know each other after many years of absence. I would say maybe 15, 16 years of absence. So that's the play. I also call it my lesbian love triangle play, but I say one of them's dead.
Okay. Okay. I think that I want to find out how you connected with Ashley and the role that she plays in this, and how we connected with Paul. And then we have an excerpt that we are going to share with the audience, which I think is just, it really encapsulates what is going on in this piece. So how did we find, Ashley, how did you find this piece? And how did Paul become involved with the filming of the staged production? And how did all of that happen? Okay, because everything is left in the theater. What are we going to do with it? Okay.
Oh, this is amazing. Can I just say that Mirrors for me was an answered prayer. I got an email from my manager about an audition. And the great thing with theater, unlike film and TV, sometimes every now and then you do, but with theater, when you get auditions for stuff, you get the script, right? Because they want you to come in and know the full context of the size that you're going to be auditioning with. So I got the script, and I think I was on my way to work. And was like, missed like my subway stop going to the school because I was so into the play. And I was like, I had just, you know, had that actor moment on the train running around and pounding the pavement to stuff that I did not care about. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have got to work on stuff that I actually care about. It's like what Paul was saying. I'm like, I can't do another thing. Like, whatever. Jobs pay money. It's great. We like money. We like to internet shop, as we all, as Azure was talking about before we started this. But I was like, I need to do stuff that makes me feel fulfilled. And like, I don't feel like I'm doing that. And this email popped into my inbox and I read the play and I was like, I need it. I have to like, one, go in for this and like give it everything I got. And I got to spend a lot of time with the sides. And one of the things that I think about with Ludovica that she always remembers from when I came to the audition, she's like, you're the only one who wore a dress. That other actors came in and didn't wear dresses. And I was like, it's 1960. Yeah, I wore a dress. Like, we're in the country. I'm from the South. I know how that go down. I'm wearing a dress. For me, it was like this answered prayer of like, oh my gosh, I love the script. I loved Azure's words. And I loved that it was quirky and odd and laugh out loud funny and really sweet and moving. And these beautiful passages for Bird of just like, oh man, like, we don't always get to, you know, sometimes even within the Black sort of theater realm, the women don't get to speak a whole lot sometimes, right? You're just there, you have those lines and you cry and stuff like that. But there's some beautiful passages that Azure has written. And I love that it was a story that we don't get to see. We don't get to see these stories that give representation to the LGBTQIA plus community. We don't get to see that in the Black community. We don't get to see that set in other worlds and done with such beautiful like nuance and subtlety. And I just was, I fell in love with it immediately. It was like, I need all of this. So I felt really blessed to have been on this journey all the way through COVID and Black Box Theaters in the East Village, you know? So yeah.
Who came up with the idea to film the stage production? Azure, can you answer that question for us? And how did you find Paul
to get involved? So, you know, I'm not really sure who came up with the idea. I know Ludovica approached me with an idea of filming it after the tragic shutdown on March 12th. You know, we were all having a lot of feelings. I mean, I know my friends were like, where are you? And I'm like, I'm in my house, in my feelings for like, you know, cannot be found. You know, when you ask this question about how do we know each other, I just want to say that I frequently work with collaborators multiple times. Mm-hmm. I really believe in building strong relationships with my artistic collaborators. And so one of the things that we do when we start a project is that we play the, like, how do you know Azure game? Because sometimes people come from different projects, but it always feels like family. You know, I know that that's something that Ludovica commented on at our first rehearsal, was just like, wow, everybody's just getting along so well, you know, having a good old time. And so Paul, I know, because we both worked at a charter high school in Brooklyn as teaching artists together. And so when Ludovica said, do you know anybody who can film this? I said, you know, I think I do know somebody. Let me give you Paul's contact info. And see how this worked out. I mean, I felt like it could be really serendipitous, but I also didn't say anything to Paul until I knew they were on the project because, you know, there's a thin line between serendipity and awkward. So thankfully we're on the serendipity side.
Okay. Paul, how do you follow that?
It was great. I mean, it was so serendipitous. I honestly, like, just because of where I was at too, I was looking for a feature film project. I felt like I was going more like this whole year. Honestly, 2020 has changed a lot in terms of where my head was going at and the type of stuff I wanted to help create and the type of stuff I wanted to direct. I was like, I freaked the F out. Ooh. Let me back up real quick so you can get a nice, good, clean take.
Okay. This is live, dude. This is live.
Oh, it's live?
It's live.
Mm-hmm. I freaked out. Sorry. So anyway, okay. But when I heard though, I definitely, I was just excited. I don't know. I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No worries. So you're asking like how do I respond to, what again?
Connecting to Mirrors, coming into the project. Yes.
Yeah. The script was already solid when the first three pages were just from my playwriting background. I'm a huge critic on just how do you start and how do you end? And when Bird flips out over the mirror, it just happens in the first few moments. You just don't expect it. But when I saw it, I was like, oh. You know what I mean? I kind of just leaned in. I was like, oh, what? I just couldn't put it down after that. Like, that was a pivotal moment for me. And seeing that on screen was another thing entirely. It feels even more powerful. Just see that time and time reiteration first. Like, you know, I think the first time I saw it was on just video when they had like an archive footage thing. And I got to see it in the rehearsals. And I got to see it in real life. And it just slowly morphed and morphed. But I think that... when I was just asked to come on, it was this thing of how do I, you know, navigating the thing of working like as a co-director with Lavika, because she handled the stage directing and I did the film directing, was one that own challenge of trying to balance those different responsibilities out, but also working collaboratively with like on a team. But two, it just felt like a nice, perfect fit because of what I was already desiring in my heart to start working on. I want to do more feature narrative projects that were along the type of things that I wanted to talk about and the topics I felt like we haven't really explored or at least highlighted. Cause I'm always aware that I'm not the only person that has these ideas. And I think one of the things I enjoy about directing film and producing is it's a teamwork. It's always like inevitably a collaborative spirit that always wins out. You know what I mean? Like, it's not about me. It's about helping an artist's like vision come to the screen and making that the best possible way. So I think it was very serendipitous. And, you know, also just kismet because Azure and I already like just got along so well and I already love their energy. And we're just already just like, I know you're just a badass writer. So I bet a writer. So,
well, you can say that.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
Well, and I'll say that Ashley and Paul actually already knew each other, and Paul lives in the same building as our lead, Suzanne. So that's why I was like, I'm not going to say anything because this would be great, but if it's not great, I don't.
It's like one beautiful chocolate world. Yeah. Right? Exactly. Paul and I know each other from many moons ago. We were in a play together. Called She Like Girls by another amazing Black playwright, Chisa. And
Chisa Hutchinson?
We did She Like Girls at the New Ohio, I mean, many years ago. So that's how I knew Paul and was like, oh man, this is crazy. So once we all like kind of knew and started emailing us, they're like, oh, Paul. And I looked at the name, I'm like, I know Paul. I worked with Paul on a few things on this, on some film stuff. And
you're on some, my first films and stuff. Yes. I'm telling you, that's why I had a whole like happy dance. It was like screaming a whole bunch. I don't know what my inner thought was going on, but it was, I just started realizing how much it was intertwined and how fun this was going to be. And it, I mean, even on set, it was just fun. It was like a huge, like you said, like a big family of just like, just positivity and people kind of working collaboratively in a way that I just kind of feel like, honestly, there's something that I missed about working with Black folks on an art, like on an art space and working with theater. I missed theater. So this really like fulfilled a lot for me. But that magic that's there, I don't know how to describe it, but it, when it was there, like, yeah. I you can't replace it. I'll never forget that. I mean, even to this day, I'm just like, just happy and thankful that I got to be a part of this, you know? So, yeah.
Okay. So Max, can you play the excerpt from Mirrors for us, please?
People just come in. I just don't think that Ray.
Been doing a lot of thinking to myself lately. How you say you know my mama again?
Is you feeling all right? I told you on the day you got here that your mama and me went to the same...
I remember what you told me. Ain't nothing wrong with my memory. The thing I can't figure is what business you and my mama had living together for so long? And if you're such great friends, why you two all of a sudden stopped being so close once she moved out? And why you got pictures like this of the two of you all snuggled up together, hidden all over the house, but Mama didn't ever have none, at least none that I seen.
Mama Jean.
And why ain't know who the hell you was until just a week ago? But you seem to think you got a damn good idea about who I am.
Now wait just a minute.
Because what it looked like to me is you won't let me have no kind of life. Won't let me enjoy one of the few nice things my mama left behind. Won't let me see Ray when I want to, even though you know his intentions is true and he's gonna marry me. It seems like all you can do is sit up in this dusty old house, acting all superstitious, making me miserable, and pining over my mama like a pathetic old bull dyke who ain't got
enough. No! I won't have it! I won't have it in this house! I won't have you there standing in judgment of me. Ain't no way and ain't no how. I get enough of that every time I set foot out that door. I know I've done things in this life that wasn't right. Don't you think I know that? Every time I look in your face, I feel it. I know it for sure. But I'm trying to make the best of things.
Wow. This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and we are speaking with Azure and Ashley and Paul about Mirrors. You just heard a portion, an excerpt from the play, and I just wanted to get your response, Azure, by hearing those words. What happens when you hear your words coming out of these marvelous actors' mouths?
There are so many layers. I really deeply trust the people who are embodying these characters. So I know they know what it is. I don't have to worry so much about, you know, them getting it right or understanding what it is. I can really enjoy their performance and celebrate them as artists, which is what I work really hard to do, is empower and celebrate the artists that I work with to help them reach their goals. And I like to remind them of their goals. I think that people look at actors in particular as kind of a mouthpiece, right? As disposable in a particular way that I think gets worse when you add in layers of marginalization. And for me, I just love it when, you know, when they do well, I'm doing well, you know, and vice versa. So it's a beautiful thing to have a moment where they're getting to shine, because I feel like, you know, that throws light on all of us.
Every filmed production has a premiere. So when is the film staged production of Mirrors going to have its premiere, and where?
Well, the premiere is next Wednesday. I am looking up the location so that I can get it right. On the Parody Productions website.
Okay. It's Wednesday, November 10th.
That's correct.
Wednesday, November 10th. Mm-hmm. Do we all know what we're going to be wearing? Because when we were speaking before we went on the air, we were all talking about how we love to shop. Mm-hmm. And how Black people just love to dress anyway. So...
It's very true. You know, Suzanne, who plays Bird Wilson, and I have been texting about what we're going to wear. Ashley Scott, who plays Annabelle Pearson, and I actually went to go see a play this past Sunday, and we were talking about what we're wearing. My mom actually texted me some of her options, because my mom is going to be there, y'all. And so I had to let her know we're going to be dressing. So, I don't know the exact outfit, but I know it's going to have sequins in it.
The sequins. Yes. Yes.
Sequins.
Yes. Maybe the blackest thing you've ever said, Azure. Sequins.
Okay. Sequins.
Okay. And also, in addition to the premiere of the film stage production of Mirrors, it's going to be part of Parody Productions' awards ceremony and celebration, where they will also announce two other commission members that came through the same way that Azure came through Parody. And have you found it yet?
You know, no? I do have the information, but the thing is, I think they don't have it on there, because you need to get it online. You
can have it
pop up at the event, y'all. It's a pandemic still. So what you need to do is go into the Parody Productions website, get your ticket, and then they will give you that prized information.
Yeah, absolutely. It is online. I do have it. I just wanted to give you.
I was like, I don't know if I'm supposed to give it. I don't want to get scolded. So
yeah. The bottom line is it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid in person, where you have to be fully vaccinated, and please don't yell at me or send me notes about vaccines or anything like that. Okay. It is just the law here in New York. You have to be fully vaccinated to be inside, to go to a theater. If you want to see theater, that is what's happening. But if you do not wish to do that, you can also participate online through streaming. So it's at the Manny Center, at the Manny Cantor Center at 197 East Broadway in Manhattan. It starts at 6 p.m. But go to parodyproductions.org. That's parodyproductions.org, where you can get more information and find out how you can support Parody Productions in many ways. Before we wrap this up, I do have a couple of more questions. Is that, and I think you've answered it in part through this conversation. What do you want people to take away from experiencing Mirrors? And anybody, I'd like all three of you to answer it. So Azure, you can begin first.
Thank you. Yeah, I really love creating pieces that people can chew on. So if they have questions, if they have feelings, they have lingering thoughts, there are conversations happening, that's what I want. You know, I started writing in part because I wanted more for Black people, entertainment-wise. So, I think it's great. If you have questions or thoughts, that's what I want you to have.
Ashley?
I love that, Azure. I think for me, these characters are so complex. And again, we don't get to see that so much. And you know, there is no one way of blackness. There is no one way. Like, they're just, like, we're such a broad people. And it's so beautiful to get to see that embodied in these characters. And as an actor, I mean, the joy that it gives you to just get to, like, go do that and be a part of that. So I would love for people to take away being proud of, like, getting to see black folk as complex, complicated, sometimes messy, hot mess, but also beautiful people. And also that this is something new. This is a new lane. We're walking into this new world of film, theatrical production. I think there is something special about theater, like Paul was saying, that you just can't get any other way. Even just listening to that clip, you know, that's a clip from a scene that, like, I don't remember us doing that. Like, we do it, but you're in it, so you don't remember it. I'm listening to it, like, oh my God, this is like a thing. But that we are walking into this new world of this hybrid theater film thing, which is exciting, and it makes stuff accessible. I was a little kid in a small town. We didn't really have theater, you know, and if we did, like, we couldn't necessarily afford to go to Greenville and go see whatever touring production from Broadway was at the Peace Center. So to know that, like, there's going to be tons of kids and different people around the world who can watch this, you know, once it's finally streaming is incredible. And I'm excited about what this means for the theater world and the film world in general. Yeah.
And Paul.
I think to jump off of Ashley's comment on the hybrid of film and theater, that's a huge thing. I think being able to showcase these artists' work in this new medium, which for me, I've always wanted to experiment more with that. I'd used this idea, this concept of, like, the black space, which is I combined literally the idea of focusing on just the bodies themselves on stage, which in theater, in a black box theater, that is what we're really doing with our minds, kind of like subconsciously, is that we're focusing on the different bodies on stage and that's it. So I want to create an actual embodiment of that on screen, and being able to take that and to choreograph it with the movements of the camera so that it feels, there are moments of the theatrical moments that I purposely tried to maintain from that I saw in the archive footage. And what I kind of felt like, you know, this is what I this is what the cast and Azure and everything else was going for. But then also having those moments of, like, well, we have the freedom of film, so we don't have to do this all in one take. And we only had 4 days to shoot this, which is not normal at all. Like, when I was first given the project, I was like, yo, we need 28 days to shoot this. Cause that's what, you know what I mean? Like, just my producer brain was like, oh, that's 28 day shots. And they're like, no, we only got 4. We got this theater. So there, so there's, like, a lot of creativity that went in, like, a lot of pre-panning. It's about a couple of months of just me doing the test footage, going to the rehearsals, figuring that out, just so we get the best possible, like, captures of this performance and the words. Like, how do I get this out in a way that is honest and still, you know, paying homage to these different tropes or these different moments that we love in theater. And then how do I also take a step back and say, you know what, this moment here can live a little bit more abstractly, but still convey what the script says. I think what I want people to take away from this is to look at this and say, you know what, I think we should do this. I want to see other theatrical companies or theater companies kind of want to say, you know what, during the winter months when there's a spike, or maybe we, you know, there's another weird thing with COVID happening, we have options now. We're not dead in the water. We can still make, like, theater. Like, theater still can exist and survive in this new medium. And yeah, I think I just want to see more of a trend like that. Almost like how there's Dogma 95, where you know, the filmmaking, where they try to keep it very stripped down so that we can get honest storytelling. I think this could be another advent of that, where we're taking these things where they're character-driven, strong character-driven strips that exist on stage, and giving them another life on a digital format, and having that live in that in between zone. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's important.
I want to thank Azure D. Osborne Lee, Paul a notice the second. I love saying the second. And Ashley Noel Jones for being with us tonight to talk about the film stage production of Mirrors, which is premiering Wednesday, November 10th as part of Parody Productions Awards Ceremony and Celebration. You can find out more at parodyproductions.org. And we're going to end the show with the way that we began, with a live a cappella performance by Ashley, who also serves as the musical director of the production, and she sings these songs as part of the production. So once again, thank you for listening, and tune in next week for the next Backstage Stories. And Ashley, it's yours.
Soon one morning, death comes creeping in the room. Soon one morning, death comes creeping in the room. Yeah, soon one morning, death comes creeping in the room. Oh my Lordy, what shall I do? I said, hush and hush and listen, somebody's calling my name. Hush and listen, somebody's calling my name. Oh, hush and listen, somebody's calling my name. Oh my Lord, oh my Lordy, what shall I do? Sing it again. Oh my Lord, oh my Lordy, what shall I do?
Ashe, we'll see you next week.
Untitled, produced and hosted by Malika Lee Whitney, will be heard on Fridays from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Untitled presents features on the arts, culture, education, and social issues. You will also enjoy music from a variety of genres. Special guests complement the program with insightful and engaging conversation. That's Untitled, Fridays from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. over listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Hey guys, I'm Harriet Cole, host of Dream Leapers. I want to tell you that I have an amazing guest this Friday that you do not want to miss. Her name is Chloe Louvoiseau. She has written a book, compiled a book called Life I Spare, Intimate Stories from Black Women on Identity, Healing, and Self-Trust. She tells her own story of what she describes as being a nomad, growing up on the continent of Africa, living all over the United States and through different countries in Africa, settling here in the United States, and, you know, her coming of age stories. But as well, there are 25 other women who are included in this book, from Elaine Welteroff to Julie Wilson to just a bevy of women who are prominent in their own right, telling their truth to help us all learn how to face the realities of our lives and heal. So please join me on Friday for Dream Leapers at 9 a.m. for my conversation with Chloe Louvoiseau.
Hey, y'all, I'm having a ball. I hope you're doing fine. Because anytime is a happy time for a birthday party ride.
BAI listeners, we, the host of the Harlem Connection, want to thank you for listening over the past year as we've reconnected you to the artists who helped establish Harlem as a cultural mecca.
And we're throwing ourselves a birthday party, but we're giving you a gift of music.
Friday, November 5th at 10 p.m.
And Sunday, November 7th at 3 a.m.
Here on 99.5 FM
and WBAI.org.
And the Harlem Connection's available afterwards on demand on WBAI.org/archive.
Join us Friday at 10 p.m. or Sunday at 3 a.m. and invite as many friends as you can.
Yeah, but, you know, it's BYO. All the guys can find a girl. If you stay apart, we're going to move and groove until we prove that we're going to shake the brakes in your heart.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music, history, and social commentary, along with expert discussion of the important issues and events of today and yesterday.